This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Lola. Sponsors like Lola keep the lights on here at Bladder Presents HQ, so please give that ad spot a listen and keep an ear out for that promo code later in the episode. Said episode starts right now.
He had that gift for dealing with all people. He was really rather gifted at seeing what you might need him to be and being that.
Just when you think there's nothing else to say about Ted Bundy, along comes Amazon's Ted Bundy falling for a killer to try to change your mind. Does it? We'll be talking about that in our first Most Wanted section, and the discussion of pure evil will continue in the second Most Wanted section with the case of Shelley Notek, as we dig into Greg Olson's ruthlessly detailed yet curiously incurious, If You Tell. You won't be using the verb to wallow for a while. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 130. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, where we try to find the true crime that's worth your time. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm joined once again by Stephanie Early Green. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Before we get started, a couple of notes. First of all, construction continuing apace, one door down from Bladder HQ. So if there's drilling, there's nothing I can do about it, and I apologize. Second of all, our first content warning of the episode. This section will be touching on sexual assault, post-traumatic stress responses, and is about Ted Bundy. So please listen with care. So we'll be talking in our first Most Wanted section about Ted Bundy falling for a killer, the five-part docuseries that dropped on Amazon Prime last week. I'm not going to get into Ted Bundy's case file because we don't actually have all day. So here's the case file for this series from Amazon's landing page. Quote, after years of silence, Ted Bundy's long-term girlfriend, Elizabeth Kendall, her daughter, Molly, and other survivors come forward for the first time in a docuseries that reframes Bundy's crimes from a female perspective. The series reveals how Bundy's pathological hatred of women collided with the culture wars and feminist movement of the 1970s in one of the most infamous crime stories of our time. I did watch the entire thing. I was, in spite of myself, somewhat impressed. Stephanie, how far into it did you get, and what did you kind of think of it overall?
I got through four. I probably would have kept watching, which was surprising because the first episode was not good, I didn't think. It was just so scattered, and believe it or not, before I started watching this, I didn't read that little case summary that you just gave. So I didn't actually know what angle the series was taking.
Right.
And the first episode did not super help me with that. It was all over the place, trying to like stuff everything that ever happened in the 70s into like a half hour or however long these are, hour long episode, plus interviews with Liz Kendall, plus interviews with her daughter, plus on and on and on. But I pushed through, and by episode two, it started to find its footing a little bit more. So overall, I enjoyed it. But I still think, even though I enjoyed it, I think it could use with a little bit more focus, and trimming.
Yeah, I agree. I would say that this would have been fine at four episodes. The last episode feels like, I think it's called Aftermath. It's quite a bit shorter than the other episodes, and it doesn't feel all that crucial to the series overall. And I agree that they did not do this was a big swing to sort of say, like, here's where feminism and the women's movement were at the time that this was happening, and try to I don't even know what word I want, correlate these
connect
two things. I don't think that's a swing that's not worth taking, but I think maybe that's a separate series, or you need different episodes that are set up with a little more care and are not also trying to focus on the also worthwhile and never before heard stories of Elizabeth Kendall and her daughter, who like functionally lived with this person for years. So
yeah,
I would agree with that. With that said, they had some amazing like contemporary footage and clips within the docuseries. Clip two is from a 1973 documentary called Rape, A Preventative Inquiry, and is just like convicted rapists sitting around Chico, I guess, rapping about their crimes and how women should respond. This was part of a larger sequence where they were talking about women being conditioned not to fight back in a sexual assault situation. Here's clip two.
The best thing to do if you're in a rape situation is submit, submit, submit until it hurts, because it's going to hurt a lot less in the long run.
So they have methods of self-defense, they have programs for girls, but the average girl on the street that's hitchhiking says, it couldn't happen to me, so she doesn't take that self-defense course.
Self-defense course wouldn't help her, man.
A self-defense course would get her killed is what it'd get.
Hey, Jeff. The woman that I was with, Jeff, she fought back and she's dead.
I mean, like,
yeah,
it doesn't quite fit. And
no.
For a bunch of reasons, like, this is an astounding document that this film got made and is being resurfaced. Really, like, I just sort of paused the second episode and was like, holy shit. Like, I just don't think that something like that would be made today. It was like the film version of the precursor to VICAP. It's really something, and it's really quite startling, but it also belongs in a more academic docuseries about that generally. Sorry, it's go not, ahead.
Those guys weren't Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy was like a different beast, right? So
yeah.
I'm not sure, like, they could have, I feel like they had all these threads, right? And they kept following threads in different directions, which made the film feel super scattered. So each one of those threads, for example, that one.
Yes.
Or, you know, the thread about what it was like to be a female police officer in the 70s, or the thread about Watergate. Each of them are interesting in their own right, and you could make an entire film series about one of those and somehow try to relate it to Ted Bundy if you wanted to, but you can't fit all of it in one series.
Yeah.
You can, but then you end up with this, which is like so unfocused that my husband was watching it with me and for the first episode, and he's like, what is this? I was like, oh, it's about Ted Bundy. He's like, how? Like, he wasn't there for the whole thing. But yeah, it was too much following all those different things.
And I think that the ambition is, generally speaking, not a bad thing. I just wish that this had been split off into like three different documentaries.
Yeah.
One about the effect, like, just if you remove Ted Bundy from the center of the Ted Bundy story and you survey the damage that he left behind, there's that part of it, which I think is the main thing that this series is trying to do and the main thing it does the best.
Yeah, I agree.
Particularly since Elizabeth Kendall did write a memoir and then like pulled it out of print, I believe, like 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And really has not been heard from. Her daughter has not, I think, been heard from prior to now. Some of these survivors have not been heard from. Durange tends to participate in these films and series, but his first victim who managed to survive.
Amazing.
I don't remember hearing from her before. I could be wrong. So it's trying to do that. It's trying to tell you where we were culturally with the idea of sort of thinking about and avoiding and prosecuting aunt sexual assault in the early to mid 70s. And you've got female law enforcement officers really having to struggle to even be that and to make themselves heard in the context of this case, which like I'll watch a 10-part docuseries about that.
Absolutely. Me too.
But they bring that up. They spend a lot of time on it in the first episode, and then you kind of don't hear about it again until towards the end, which is unfortunate. But I think the main, idea here is to subtract Ted Bundy from this narrative and keep him from doing what he usually does, which is that he is this dark star of charisma, and he always pulls the focus almost no matter what you do. Do you think they did that?
Because I'm not convinced they totally did.
I'm not. At some points, I think they did a good job. But you could really feel the effort as well, which I guess that's okay. I think it's okay to sort of acknowledge with the work. This is a very difficult guy to talk about the aftermath and the ripple effects of his monstrous acts and not put him in the middle. It's very hard.
I think they did that the best when they were focusing on each individual victim and how each murder, like you said, rippled out and affected the friends and family of each victim and the community of each victim. But then inevitably they'd come back to Ted and footage of him trying to schmooze his way through interviews or,
When he comes off the elevator and is sort of having his moment with the deputy reading the charges, like I've seen that entire sequence like four times in the last year in different projects. We know he did that. Don't give him the attention. I know he's been dead 30 years, but still.
Yeah. Well, he's probably enjoying this from hell. So.
Yeah, probably. Or if, if there is a hell, he is there and he can't get Amazon Prime and can't watch himself. Let's hope.
That's a curse.
How did you feel specifically about the Kendalls and their portion of this story?
They are, well, especially Liz, they're complicated. I mean, in the beginning, I'm like, oh my God, this woman weepily like reading love letters from Ted Bundy is like not a good look.
No.
And at times during the documentary, while she was talking about how she convinced herself that he was innocent, even when there was like vast amounts of evidence against him that she herself had witnessed, she knew.
And had already called the cops.
Yeah, she called the cops and she knew he had crutches in his room. Like, she knew it was him on some level. However, when she did call the cops one time, I think the second time she called the cops, they like convinced her, well, we already looked into him and he's not a suspect. Like, stop calling us. At least that's what she said.
In two different states, I think.
Yeah. So she, at times that you want to shake her, you want to be like, what is wrong with you? And then at other times, she's just such a tragic figure. You know, you feel really sorry for her. She grew up, I think, Mormon in Utah, sheltered, woman who kind of like didn't have any skills or ambition. Her marriage fell apart and then she stumbled into this relationship with this really charming, handsome guy, and that was kind of all she had. That was my reading of her.
I think so. And that, you know,
right,
he's too good to be true, but she might not necessarily have had the breadth of experience in her life to see that or to like have that gut instinct that you're like, really? Like you're up making pancakes for the kid? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'd be a little sketched out by that. Yeah. I think she's also, somewhat informed. Not that there's anything wrong with this. It was just noticeable to me that because she has, I think, more than four decades of sobriety, sometimes the way she thinks about her relationship with Ted and sort of interacts with it is on, like, in an addiction paradigm, mm-hmm. which I don't think is necessarily incorrect in terms of, like, we've all been in those relationships where you know it's diminishing returns, but you're like, well, what else is there? It used to be great. Anyway, here's clip three where she's speaking about their relationship in that way in an attempt to kind of make it comprehensible to us.
We had several good years where it was just really fun and intense and wonderful. And I think kind of like almost any addiction or any drug, you keep thinking of the first part of something and you think you can get back to that state, whereas things started to change, but I still was hopeful that we would be in love like we were in the beginning.
I mean, if you're sort of looking for an explanation as to why she would stay, like, there's that, there's pattern recognition, even.
Yeah.
Like, that you wouldn't necessarily, recognize the what seem like very obvious, you know, clues and evidence that this is the same guy, because it can't be that guy because of pattern recognition. So, you know, I don't judge her. Certainly, I don't judge Molly.
No.
Listening to Molly, for me, first of all, she resembles
Kristen Bell.
Kristen Bell.
Yeah.
To this degree that is somewhat disconcerting.
It is, yeah.
And has a somewhat Joey Lauren Adams voice. And she is very... I think she has been working through this for most of her life. So she is very articulate on why she, as a child, was seduced, for lack of a better word, by Bundy. But she also starts to talk about him, like, they're playing one of their normal games, or they're playing hide and seek, and one day he's naked.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, well, that's where that kind of started. But then there's no follow-up with that.
I had that in my notes. Like, well, what happened? Like, was he sexually abusing you? Or did this just happen once? Or, you know?
Yeah. I mean, not that I necessarily wanted to know that he was even worse than we already understood him to be. There's a lower place for Ted Bundy? Like, mm-hmm. please. We're all set, really. But I did find it odd that the series would leave that there. And I wonder why that happened. Do you think it was just because it was sort of generally dropping some threads overall, or do you think something else happened?
Well, probably, yeah, that they just had too many balls in the air and couldn't follow up on all of them. And I also wonder if maybe she didn't want to talk about it, or, but then I also wonder, well, did the mother know? And I feel like there's so many questions you need to delve into once that's been surfaced. So I don't know what other reason they could have for leaving it out. What did you think?
Well, it did strike me that, like, maybe she did talk about it more and they decided that it was too, like, the information was just too grievous to include. Maybe the two of them asked Trish Wood, I think her name is, the filmmaker, to take out mentions of that. But she does talk at a couple of points about not telling her mother at that time because she didn't want to upset the already listing apple cart of their relationship.
Right.
And then it comes up again. And then there's I'm going to jump ahead to clip five, where Molly is talking about the death of Kimberly Leach, who is the 12-year-old that Ted Bundy murdered in Florida. And it's heartbreaking to watch her sort of coming back to this place with it again. But then there's a lot of stuff that she started to say before and doesn't finish saying in this section, which is interesting. Here's clip five.
This girl could be my twin, you know? We were the same. And I really grappled with, does this have anything to do with me? And that's devastating.
I mean, on the surface, what she's talking about is, you know, if our family had stopped him or whatever, I guess. But then I feel like there's also that, does this have anything to do with me, means was he trying to replace the satisfaction he was getting from abusing me when he was here?
Right.
Which is, I mean, I guess she actually didn't have to keep talking about it because we're filling in all these blanks, but yes. I mean, yeah, it's a lot, this series. Like, you know, are there a lot of things going on at once and it's sort of disorganized? Yeah, but it still has its devastating effect.
And another thread that they picked up that kind of, I don't know, I'm glad he's in there, but it also was another like layer, was the Ted's brother.
Oh yeah.
He made me so sad.
He really did. They would have him start talking always off screen, and it would always be a little adjustment because their voices, Ted and Rich, are similar enough.
Yeah.
And they're showing a picture of the two of them together. And that was an interesting thread that wasn't picked up. Like, I understand why they wouldn't necessarily want to get into Ted's own childhood and the fact that for years and years he thought his mother was his sister, mm-hmm. and he was raised by his grandparents and all of these other sort of, it's, you know, was it possible that she was a sex worker, and how does that tie into, you know, various serial killer triads and whatever else. Like, I get that they don't want to focus too much on him, but given that this was the influence of a woman in his life, it was interesting that didn't come up.
Yeah.
And oh, Rich. Yeah, I'm not.
He was rough.
He doesn't seem well.
No, like in any way, shape, or form.
No.
He looks physically unwell, and his way of speaking, he has either had a substance abuse problem or currently has one. That would be my guess. And he just seems very sad. I mean, it was tough watching him.
Yeah. And they say he's been living under an assumed name. He's in just a camper with his cat.
Yep.
And it's like, if this cat gets out, that I think that's it for Rich. Like, this cat is like his lifeline. This is one thing that this series does extremely well and doesn't push too hard on it, I don't think, is to make it clear that there is a huge like blast radius from this guy.
Yeah.
From in his family, in the every single family that he touched, even tangentially, just scorched the earth. The last clip in this section is from one of the victim's sisters, Linda Healy, talking about how her disappearance just blighted everything in every direction for the Healy family.
You know, it was hard for us to even talk about her. To bring her up caused so much pain for my mother that it's almost like we had to forget her. Completely. You can't remember the good times because that causes pain. So you forget. So my family lost not only my sister, we lost memories because we couldn't share that because it was too painful. So there was a hole there was a hole bigger than the loss of my sister. It was the hole of the happy times of my family.
I mean,
it's brutal.
Yeah, brutal. And I thought that was very, you know, you can sort of hear the mournful cello, mm-hmm. which felt a little manipulative. And you're seeing home movies of the whole family and Linda when she was like a toddler. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's harsh, but, you know, good. Like, let's remember that that's what's really happening.
Right.
It's not for our entertainment necessarily, these docuseries. It's for like testimony for all the other victims that were left behind to deal with this smoking crater that is losing a family member in this way. So in that respect, I thought the docuseries was good. I saw things I hadn't seen before. Granted, by episode 4, it's like, if I have to see that photo of Ted Bundy in that little blue hat one more time, I'm very tired. It's like Ken Burns' Civil War when you're like, oh, a moody sunset shot of a cannon.
Right.
Okay. Just maybe cut this.
Yeah.
VO. But overall, like, it's overly ambitious. It's a little scattered in the beginning. The last episode is not necessary, but I would still recommend the series. I think it tried to do a whole bunch of things and actually did a couple of them quite well.
Agreed.
Are you going to bother finishing the?
I might.
The last 37 minutes.
Well, here's the thing, Sarah. This weekend was very busy, and so I didn't get to watch my normal Sunday night / Monday night rotation of reality TV. So after I catch up with The Bachelor and 90 Day Fiancé, then we'll see if I have time for Ted Bundy. But I might.
I hear you. I got a lot of Teen Mom and Life After Lockup sitting on the DVR to kind of cleanse the palate.
I mean, you
got to
prioritize.
Yeah. Again, this is not an easy watch, but I think that if you were kind of like, this won't tell me anything new, it might. Mm-hmm. And I really hope this filmmaker goes back and unpacks what she was trying to cram into like 52 minutes in the first episode into two more docuseries, one about women in law enforcement in the 70s. And hey, fold Lori Bembedek in there because that story is so crazy. And two, like ideas about self-defense and mm-hmm. sexual assault. Like, I mean, I think she's onto something with both of those and they need to be unpacked more. That's all.
Yeah.
All right. That's Ted Bundy, Falling for a Killer. It is available on Amazon Prime right now. And now a word from our sponsor. What is Lola? Lola is a female-founded company that offers high-quality period and sexual wellness products made with natural ingredients. Lola's tampons, pads, liners, and cleansing wipes are all made with 100% organic cotton. No toxins, dyes, or synthetic fibers. Lola products are made with ingredients that are easy to feel good about. Lola also makes it easier for women to get their feminine care products, with customizable subscriptions to fit every body and routine. Lola delivers exactly what she needs, exactly when she needs it. Lola believes in total ingredient transparency. The FDA does not require brands to disclose a comprehensive list of ingredients in their feminine care products, so most of them don't. But Lola lists every ingredient in the products right on the box. And those products are made with 100% organic cotton. Most conventional feminine care brands go with a mix of synthetic ingredients, some of which include rayon, plastic, and polyester. Lola's period products never have any synthetic fibers or any toxins, dyes, fragrance, or chlorine bleach. And Lola can make your period a little bit easier because there are 4 ways to customize your subscription to fit your specific needs. 1, you can choose your product type, organic cotton tampons, pads, liners, or wipes, or a combination of any or all of those. 2, you can tailor your absorbencies, mixing various tampons from light to super plus and either ultra-thin day pads or night pads. 3, you decide how many boxes you want delivered, and 4, you decide how often you want a shipment. Every 4 weeks, every 8 weeks, it's up to you. You can cancel, skip an order, or modify your subscription anytime. Lola will email you 2 days before your shipment goes out in case you need to make any tweaks. I love this aspect. Like a lot of women, I get a period that isn't always the same from month to month. And after more than 3 decades in the field, as it were, for me, the biggest little annoyance of the period process is the million tampon combo packs littering my bathroom shelving as I try in vain to get the various absorbencies to even up so they run out at the same time. Lola eliminates that small aggro. Plus, whatever I end up ordering, the minimalist packaging is pretty great. It's discreet, and it doesn't go overboard with the saturated pinks and purples like menstruating is a trip to Lady Six Flags. If you want to try the convenient, personalized Lola experience for yourself, what better time? For 30% off your first month subscription, visit mylola.com and enter blotter when you subscribe. That's MYLOLA.com, plus the code blotter, BLOTTER, to get 30% off your first month. Thanks so much, Lola. All right, our second most wanted section gets, if it's possible, even grimmer than Ted Bundy. We are talking about the December 2019 book from Greg Olson, who has written, I think, a dozen true crime books on various cases. It's called If You Tell. Stephanie, you brought us this experience. Do you want to talk about why, or will it become obvious once we get into our discussion?
I think it'll be obvious. I just saw it mentioned in People magazine, and I'm like, oh, People magazine's like repping a true crime book. I'm going to check it out because, you know, why not? And oh boy, it was a lot.
That strikes me as very strange. Not that they're repping true crime, but that they wouldn't be more about like one of those like victorious escape narratives. Totally.
Right.
Had you heard of this case before you saw the review or no?
No.
Me neither.
And everyone who likes true crime, who I know, I've mentioned it to, they haven't heard of it either.
Yeah.
So, and, I mean, it's weird.
Oof. All right. So, yeah. Here's the case file again from Amazon's landing page for the book. Quote, for years, behind the closed doors of their farmhouse in Raymond, Washington, Shelley Notek subjected her girls to unimaginable abuse, degradation, torture, and psychic terrors. Through it all, Nikki, Sammy, and Tori developed a defiant bond that made them far less vulnerable than Shelley imagined. Even as others were drawn into their mother's dark and perverse web, the sisters found the strength and courage to escape an escalating nightmare that culminated in multiple murders. End quote. Before we proceed, I'll drop another content warning here. This book deals with horrible abuse, and we may be discussing some of the particulars, so as always, please listen with care for yourselves. Okay. Well, all right. I'll get into this hero's journey description of the sisters in the book copy in a second. How did you feel overall? You read this, right? You didn't listen to it?
Okay. I did read it. Yeah.
How did you feel about the overall, like the writing, the pacing? Mm-hmm. How'd you feel?
Pacing wise, pretty good. It moved along, you know, very detailed, you know, nothing that Shelley did kind of went unremarked upon. And there was a lot of crazy stuff that she was doing. Writing wise, like there's some tortured turns of phrase in there.
It starts early. Here is a clip from the Audible edition of the book. This is the narrator is Karen Peeks, who actually is really good. And at least listening to it, I think she and the way it's structured, like you're so baffled and horrified for a while that you don't notice some issues with the book. And she's a very good narrator, but this raised an eyebrow not even 2 minutes in. Here's clip six.
It takes only the mention of a single word to take her back to the unthinkable. Mom. Every now and then, she literally shudders when she hears it. A visceral reaction to a word that scrapes at her like the talons of an eagle, cutting and slicing her skin until blood runs out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I had
highlighted another, this isn't as bad as that. That's very tortured, but, okay. I'm just going to read this sentence and try to keep up.
Okay.
Divorced for more than 2 years by then, comma, she was living in a small house on Northwest Cherry Street in Vancouver when she took a call from a very distraught and, comma, now, comma, very specific Shelley Notek. A very specific Shelley Notek? Like, what? Yeah.
As opposed to the usual vague Shelley Notek?
Yeah, the undefined Shelley Notek. Like,
yes. Yeah, that anyway. she's not hard to define.
Yeah.
Just the accumulation of horrors in the first half to, like, I don't know, two-thirds of the book is very effective, but it also, for me, obscured some questions that, as the book was wearing on, I started to write down, like, why isn't this account more critical of Dave, Shelley's husband,
yeah,
who is a full participant in every revolting thing she's doing to their children.
Mm-hmm.
And his excuse is sort of like, well, you know, I was hardly home. Like, but when you were home, you were covering up deaths from starvation. You were killing your nephew so he wouldn't
yeah,
talk about the first death. What?
Yeah.
And the rendition of him in the book, at least the audio version, is somewhat folksy and henpecked. Like,
right.
I believe, spoiler ahead, I believe he's been paroled. I think he's out.
Really?
So, yeah.
God. Yeah.
And
that
she's
doesn't
up
seem
for
right.
parole. I mean, the outcome of this, like, eventually I did Google to see what happened, and, like, that she entered the same type of plea, an Alford plea, as the West Memphis Three, is like, mm-hmm, what the fuck are you doing, Washington State? Seriously. But it's not bad. It's not great writing, but it's not
no.
bad. I just feel that this particular subject of this woman who, the minute she comes on stage in the book at the age of, whatever, 13,
mm-hmm,
this is a bad seed. Like, she's obviously bad.
Yeah.
And you can relate to her father and stepmother sort of being overmatched and not knowing what to do with her and not having certain childhood development resources then that we have now. And then at a certain point, you can relate to her extremely young husband getting buffaloed into marrying her and taking her off her parents' hands. And, like, but as time goes on, it's like nobody was going to say anything.
Yeah.
Okay. We need some analysis.
Yeah.
In the text about why this is true. Like, her kids, who were absolutely suffering from, you know, Stockholm syndrome or just outright dread and trying to survive, no judgment.
No.
But other people, I don't know. Like, I can't judge them because we're not given enough information or analysis as to how this happened. It's just this toxic litany of every single horror that she perpetrated. And I'm not sure that's the best way with this story.
No, I mean, my main question, and I don't know if you'll agree, but how the hell did she get away with this without anyone noticing any, like, that's the question I wanted answered that the book never really answered. I mean, it would give hints as to, from the girl's perspective, as to why, like, no one helped them or suspected anything was wrong. But I'm like, surely, I mean, for example, the one girl, her boyfriend would, like, drop her off and then honk the horn until the mom let her in. I'm like, so he wasn't questioning at all that the mom was not going to let her in, that she would be locked out and have to sleep outside. And also, if that was the case, why couldn't she go stay with her boyfriend's family? Like, was no one in the community talking to each other? It just seemed odd.
And that it did seem like a couple of times, like, school counselors or social workers were like, we noticed that you have this homemade haircut, you smell.
Yeah. Yep.
And you have been wearing the same clothes to school every day. And this was when I think the littlest one, Tori, was still in grade school. Like, right. I just don't, and you know, I don't have kids. I don't work in the public school system, but I just feel like if that has drawn your attention, you have to follow up, and that you go to the house and, like, there's a person who is not related to the family, barely clothed, clearly starving to death and doing yard work.
Yeah.
Like, how big was this yard? Is I'm sorry to be flip.
Well, they were out there all day, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Doing yard work, yeah.
And I guess after the wallowing, like, there's wallow pit cleanup to do. This was a favored punishment of Shelley Dotek, was to make them stand in freezing cold mud and hose them down. And that was also their, quote, shower, and they didn't get soap. They got bleached, which
lie on them and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering how did this go unremarked upon in the community? It just seems crazy.
Yeah, at least once the kids are sort of, like, in public view at school each day, It does seem strange. Like, the unrelated persons, Kathy and Ron, you know, Shelley sets up her horseshit stories and makes sure everybody's going to stick to them. And so you can sort of understand how that didn't trip any alarms with law enforcement or the community.
Right.
But then
with the kids, I mean, it's like another matter. And also, I mean, we can't ask these people because they're dead, but the two separate friends/boarders who she took in and then subsequently tortured to death.
Yeah.
How did she do that? I mean, it's amazing, like, the psychological pull she must have exerted over these people. And I still didn't totally get how she did it so effectively. I mean, I guess she kind of picked vulnerable people who she knew didn't have a huge support system, and then just, you know, preyed on the holes that they each had and their need for approval and friendship. But man,
well, Ron's case in particular, like, he is off campus, so to say, for long stretches, and also is being told by Dave Notek, like, here's money, go to a shelter, leave.
Yeah.
And he won't.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, whether it's the story of the girl under the bed, which we all read in virtual true crime book club like 10 years ago, and we're like, right, girl, what are you doing? Because she would be allowed out for days at a time to go to the store unattended, and she wouldn't run. So there is clearly a, you know, prisoner control component that, like, this control that they exert and this fear dominates the victims. And, you know, I don't get it, but I've never been in that situation, thank God. So, of course, no judgments. But there's also a failure on the part of this book to analyze that or sort of make it clear. Like, he keeps repeating that we can't judge these people, which I agree. But
yeah.
Then you have to provide an analysis of how this woman who, and I will also warn prospective readers or listeners that Ron is gay, and Shelley's abuse of him involves like myriad uses of the F word, and it's extremely mm-hmm. difficult to listen to. So just another content warning there. But, you know, it's very hard for us civilians to understand how someone could take that kind of like horrible physical abuse, verbal abuse that seems to start extremely quickly and not take an opportunity to leave. Like you have to get into that for the layperson.
Yeah, exactly. That was my biggest issue with it.
And there is this moment where the oldest daughter, who was usually the focal point of the abuse if there were no quote borders in the house to be the focus of it, she, like, sort of many years after she's finally gotten out and started a new life, she is like watching a true crime show and is inspired to start admitting to her grandmother stuff that had actually happened. And I kind of felt like I needed to know what show it was, because I'm I'm nosy like that. But also how, like, why was it this? And also, like, where exactly, like, the grandmother clearly understood that her stepdaughter was a bad seed who had been lying about having cancer and myriad other things.
There's always a cancer scam.
Yeah. Like, where, I'd understand you don't want to stick your hand in that again, but they're children now.
Right.
Like, can you, you've got to do something. And why isn't the text explaining why she didn't do it?
Yeah, she was so hands-off, you know?
Is it because, like, are you not pressing these people because you don't want them to be, you don't want them to not participate? Like,
right.
If they agreed to participate, then they agreed to participate. So
grill them.
Or don't grill them, but, like, draw whatever conclusions you want. They can't control that. Jeffrey McDonald's myriad lawsuits aside. Yes, I'm going to stop using the word myriad. Here's clip 8. This is kind of a long clip, but I think it is indicative of the of this text that is, like, detailed, but sometimes about, like, too much about one part of it and not enough about others.
Nikki had always been fascinated by crime. She wanted to understand why bad people did the things they did. Before she dropped out of Gray's Harbor, she'd even had aspirations for a career in law enforcement. Her mom, she knew, was the same way. Though Nikki figured Shelley was less interested in figuring out how to catch the killer and more in how to stay ahead of the police. Then again, Shelley could surprise her. One time when they were watching Mommy Dearest, Shelley turned to her girls with a stunned expression on her face. I can't believe that a mother would do that to her kids. Nikki and Sammy had exchanged incredulous looks. Had their mom forgotten about the duct tape, the icy hot, the wallowing? That night, while they watched TV at Laura's, Nikki suddenly got very quiet in a way that felt strange to Laura, though she didn't say anything at the time. Maybe Nikki was tired from the long drive from Washington. The next morning, Nikki found her grandmother in her office, sorting through paperwork. I have something to tell you, she began. Laura could tell she'd been up all night. Nikki's eyes were wet and red. She'd obviously been crying. What is it, honey? She put her arms around her granddaughter. A long pause filled the small office. Mom and Dad killed Kathy, Nikki said finally.
Well, I mean, the finally sort of says it all. Again, I'm not judging anybody who was in this situation, and I watch Hoarders. I understand that denial is extremely powerful to extents that we don't realize sometimes, because denial. But this book is really frustrating because there's all this detail proving that Shelley Notek is a monster, but then there's no analysis of the effects on other people. There's no talking about how denial and Stockholm syndrome can function. There's no talking, there's no attempt to diagnose Shelley, which, like, okay, he's not a psychologist, but get, like,
talk to
get someone in there, yeah, to like, is she just a bad seed? Is she a sociopath? Mm-hmm. Is she a borderline personality? Like, something.
Right.
So I'm not entirely sure what to tell listeners about this.
Well, it's a pretty because quick it really, read, right?
It like, carries it's not, me right along, but then yeah, at the end of it, I'm like, dude.
I mean, it's not a huge time investment. It, you know, if you're looking for a true crime book that tells a wacky story, why not, right? But yeah, it leaves a lot of questions unanswered.
It does. And I suspect that there must be a, like, I don't know, Seattle Magazine or there's some, like, long read that gets into this case in the ways that we want it to more, right, and is even shorter. So listeners, if you know something like that exists, and you haven't found it in the show notes, because I'm going to, you know, stop this recording and go look to see if there's something that I can find. But yeah, the Goodreads reviews are pretty uniformly like, this is an amazing story that was perhaps too floridly told and not enough analysis. And I think to expect anything different from this particular author is perhaps unfair. But again, this is something you could probably read in a flight, right? So yeah. I don't think it's a waste of time. This story is bonkers, and if it does nothing else, like, all y'all mandatory reporters, eyes up. somebody should have caught this. I feel.
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
All right, well, thanks and a question mark.
As always.
In local news today, bees.
On to something more cheery, which is your other work. Stephanie, where else can listeners find your writing?
You can find me on my blog, stephanieearlygreen.com.
Outstanding. Thank you for coming back. Next time,
my pleasure.
We've had some real dark shit the last couple times.
Yes.
Maybe just
my fault.
Well, but all right, pick a book that's about just like a stolen Rembrandt, and then
okay, I'll do that for next time.
We'll just have a nice cozy conversation. We'll drink some cocktails. It'll be great.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks for coming back.
You're welcome.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, it's Toby Ball on CBS All Access's Interrogation. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? You can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on Twitter and Instagram. And in the Best Evidence newsletter, that's bestevidence.fyi. Remember, 2,000 paid subscribers means we cover the Theranos trial in person. Today's episode has been sponsored by Lola. Visit mylola.com and use that promo code Blotter for 30% off your first order. My guest has been Stephanie Earlygreen, and she's on Twitter at Eteffi. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.